Hi, this is G. A few words before the show begins. So we were yesterday with Thomas, Benoit and Angie at Groove Cafe to edit the podcast. And we very soon realized that the podcast was very technical and long. And to be fair, we were, we were madly bored and it was really hard to keep our concentration up until the end of the podcast. So one of the evolution in the format that we're going to take is that the podcast will be split in two parts. So you will first hear first part of the podcast where we will address two questions. The first one, which is how did the level of bad debt and risk evolve in the Chinese banking sector? And the second one is what caused the degradation of the financial situation of Chinese banks. Hope you enjoy it and be ready. It's quite technical. Hi, I'm Jipan, and this is China Economy Podcast, the podcast on Chinese economic current affairs. Today, let's take up the challenge to answer if China can face a banking crisis. After having spent 2 years in China, I saw it was finally time for me to start saving and investing in RMB. I wanna be a billionaire, so fucking bad. I had opened 2 years ago a bank account at ICBC, a local Chinese bank. ICBC is actually the biggest bank and company in the world, with a market cap equivalent to Portugal's GDP. I wanted to know more about the investment options that my Chinese bank offers, so I went to my bank to figure out. I just took a ticket, number 49, 8 people before me. So while we wait, let me add that exploring together my investment option in China is actually going to be a good opportunity to better understand the Chinese banking and shadow banking sector. In 2016, China has gradually started to unveil details of a restructuration plan of the national banking sector. The amount of bad debt on the bank balance sheet has continued to rise as the economy is slowing down. Many commentators have shown concern about the rising risk in the banking sector. There is a precedent. In the 90s, the banking sector balance sheet was particularly alarming and the sector was entirely restructured to avoid a banking crisis. That leads to the question, can China face a banking crisis today? We will answer in this episode the following questions. First, how did the level of bad debt and risk evolve in the Chinese banking system? Second, what caused the degradation of the financial situation of the Chinese banks? Third, how did the bank's exposure to shadow banking evolve? Fourth, what is the government's plan for the banking sector and what effect can we expect from it? Let's answer now our first question, how the level of bad debt and risk is evolving in the Chinese banking system. As the economy is gradually slowing down, the level of bad debts, debt on which the bank might not be able to be repaid, has been increasing since 2013. Those bad debts are also known as non-performing loan, NPL, pouli en taille. It does matter a lot for banks, and if I had to follow one metric to measure bank risk, I would choose this one. For a bank, the amount of its NPL indicates the amount of loans on which he is likely to suffer loss. Its NPL ratio indicates the percentage of loans that the bank might lose. How did the level of NPL evolve? At the end of 2015, the total amount of NPLs has reached 1.3 trillion yuan, growing at an annual growth rate of 51%. The NPL ratio has grown to 1.67% in 2015 compared to 1.25% in 2014. two interesting points from the data. First, clearly, we are on an increasing trend. Second, what can be surprising is that 1.67% doesn't seem too bad. For comparison, the NPL ratio in 2015 are at 4% for French banks, 1.5% for US banks, and 18% for Italian banks. So why the Chinese government bother to plan a restoration? Well, for two main reasons. The difference in accounting rules makes the international comparison difficult, and different estimate techniques show that the risk in the banking sector is actually higher. First, let's explore a very exciting subject, the difference between Chinese and international banking accounting standards. I have lost here maybe half of the four listeners, including my mom, but for those who stayed, it is actually genuinely interesting, so follow me. One of the key criteria that the Chinese accounting standard used to classify a loan as a NPL, a non-performing loan, is the value of the collateral. This criteria is not relevant in international standards. What is a collateral? Let's say that you want to go to see the last Disney movie, We Are Born in China, and you don't have enough money because the movie theater is quite expensive in China. So you ask me to lend you 100 yuan. I say okay, because it's a cool movie, but I ask you to put your bike as a collateral. This means that you still keep the ownership of your bike, but if you don't give me back my 100 yuan, then I will seize your bike. Sorry. Yo, gym rap, but it's sounding extra, extra, extra lame. Put you in your place called that real estate. The notion of collateral is central in the Chinese accounting standards, which considers that if the value of the collateral is high enough to cover the value of the loan, then the loan with a default risk is not classified as a non-performing loan, but in a category called special mention. This is particularly striking in the real estate sector, where the building is often put as the collateral for the loan, and where the level of non-performing loan is remarkably low. Overall, that leads the Chinese standards to underestimate the level of NPL compared to international standards. If we take in account the special mention loans, then the level of NPL can reach 5.5% at the end of 2015, which is higher but still okay by international standards. You can visualize that on the first graph on the website. The second reason that could justify the government plan to restructure the banking sector is that another estimation method indicates that the risk is actually higher. This method is called the implicit NPL method, and estimates the solvency of the borrower. This method has been used by the IMF and banks economists, consists simply in estimating the amount of debt held by a company that don't generate enough operating profits to pay its debt interest during the year. The IMF, for example, estimates in 2015 that 15.5% of the amount of corporate debt might be at risk. This means that 15.5% of the amount of corporate debt is held by corporates which don't generate enough operating profit to cover the interest payment of its debt. This represents 1.3 trillion USD. And seems indeed quite high. Let's reflect a minute on this number. First, we have to precise that the implicit NPL method is completely different from accounting for NPL. So even if it helps us to better evaluate banking risk, it is only an estimation. Second, this high number can be explained by the government implicit guarantee that the SOEs, state-owned enterprise, benefit when they get bank loans. We will get into that in another episode on SOEs, but for now, let's just say that as far as the government doesn't decide to let some of the SOE defaults, this situation can be sustained for quite a while. In the end, you would be wrong to use this number as a proxy for NPL. But this number indicates that the risk in the banking sector is actually higher than what the accounting number says. Conclusion. The NPL level in the Chinese banking sector has increased in later years. The level of NPL in China is actually low by international comparison. However, this is due to a large extent to the difference in accounting standards that tend to underestimate NPL level and to SOE's implicit guarantee. The implicit NPL method indicates that the level of risk in the sector is actually quite high. Next, our second question: what caused the degradation of the financial situation of Chinese banks? The degradation of the financial situation in the Chinese banking sector is visible. There is the increasing level of risk, as shown by the level of NPL. In the same time, banks' profit growth has been the slowest in 10 years in 2015, with an annual growth rate of 2.4% compared to 9.6% in 2014, as you can see on the second graph on the website. This worrying trend for Chinese banks can be explained by two major evolutions affecting the banking sector. The first evolution is the Chinese industrial slowdown. The profit of industrial firms has decreased in 2015 for the first time in the 21st century. Companies' payment delays have been extended significantly this year. The slowdown does not concern every sector with the same intensity. The heavy industrial sector is highly affected by the economic slowdown. Sectors like steel, coal, and other commodities have suffered a lot. Those industries represent a large chunk of the economy of regions in the northeast and central China, with very low GDP growth. Another really interesting point is that most of the companies present in heavy industry sectors are state-owned enterprise, SOEs, or 国有企业. This also means that overall, SOEs are not in a very healthy situation. The Chinese banks were for decades kind of sitting on a big pile of gold. Banking sector interests were tightly regulated, and the interest margin, which is the difference between the interest paid by banks for deposits and the interest received by banks for loans, were generous enough to allow banks to be very profitable without too much effort. However, this is less and less the case. The second major disruption in the banking sector is the increase in competition in the sector. And as with an increase in competition in any sector, that has a huge impact on profits. This increase in competition is due to two major reasons: the liberalization of interest rates and the competition of very liquid money market funds. The liberalization of interest rate has been progressing at a fast pace in later years. The interest rate in China has been regulated by the central bank for decades. However, the PBOC has scrapped the deposit rate ceiling in October 2015, 2 years after having scrapped the lending rate floor. That has allowed banks to compete on price, since it leaves them the possibility to offer more interesting remuneration to attract deposits from the bank next door. Nevertheless, the Chinese banking sector is largely state-owned, and big state-owned banks still tend to follow the indicative interest rate published by the central banks, limiting the fierce competition. The second element that has contributed to the increase in competition in the banking sector is the development of money market funds and wealth management products. Assets in money market funds has been doubling in 2015 from 350 billion USD in 2014 to 700 billion USD in 2015. Money market funds have become so popular in China because they offer higher interest rates than retail banks' deposits. Those funds invest in riskier class of assets, which allows them to offer higher remuneration. And you also have a very sexy mix between mobile payment and money market funds in China. Two Chinese internet giants, Tencent and Alibaba, offer access to money market funds on their online payment app. I'm opening right now Tencent app WeChat, and in a few click, I can see that the interest rate of the money market fund offered by the app is 3.5%, pretty good compared to bank interests. And it doesn't stop here. Your phone is really liquid. The app is linked directly to your bank accounts and you can decide at any moment to make a transfer. Really great deal. However, sadly, as a foreigner, I cannot open an account. Conclusion. In the Chinese banking sector, profit has decreased and risks have increased. These evolutions are due to the slowdown of industrial activity and to the increase in competition triggered by the interest rate liberalization and the development of money market funds. That was the first part of the fourth episode of China Economy Podcast on the Chinese banking sector. You can go to our website chinaeconomypodcast.com to find graphs and recommendations. Please feel free to drop us an email at chinaeconomypodcast@gmail.com. In the second part of the episode, we will answer the following question: how did the bank exposure to shadow banking evolve? And what is government planned for the banking sector and what effects can we expect from it? See you in the next part.